anywhere. And besides, what's new in political science? I'm quite satisfied with my life, thank you. I'm sure you are, Kathy replied, seeing the chink and knowing how to exploit it. You can always tell when a person is happy in their work. And you, Professor? Life couldn't be much better. As a matter of fact, there's only one real difference between us, Carolyn Ryan said. And that is? I don't know where my wife wandered off to. There's yours with Liz Elliott and the Holtzmans. I wonder what they're talking about, Bunker said. At home, at night, I sleep with a man, Kathy said sweetly. And the nice thing about it is that I never have to change the batteries. Jack turned to see his wife and Elizabeth Elliott, whose pearl necklace seemed to turn brown before his eyes, she went so pale. His wife was shorter than the National Security Advisor, and she looked like a pixie next to Libby Holtzman. But whatever the hell had just happened, Kathy was holding her ground like a mama bear on her kill, her eyes locked on the taller Elliot. He moved over to see what the problem was. Hi, honey.
Hello, Jack, Kathy said, her eyes fixed on her target. Do you know Bob and Libby?
Hi. Ryan shook hands with both, catching looks from them that he could only guess at. Mrs. Holtzman seemed about to explode, but then she took a breath and controlled herself.
You're the lucky guy who married this woman? Libby asked.
That comment made Elliot turn away first from the confrontation. Actually, she's the one who married me, I think, Jack said after a further moment's confusion.
If you'll excuse me, Elliot said, departing from the battlefield as gracefully as she could.
Kathy took Jack's arm and steered him toward the corner with the piano.
What in the hell was that all about? Libby Holtzman asked her husband.
She thought she knew most of it already. Her successful struggle not to laugh aloud had nearly strangled her.
What it's about, my dear, is that I broke an ethical rule. And you know something?
You did the right thing, Libby announced. The Marx Brothers? Three-way corner. Liz Elliott, the Queen Radical Wasp? My God.
Jack, I have a terrible headache. I mean, a really terrible one, Kathy whispered to her husband.
That bad?
She nodded.
Can we get out of here before I get nauseous?
Kathy, you don't just walk out of these things, Jack pointed out.
Sure you do.
What were you and Liz talking about?
I don't think I like her very much.
You're not the only one.
Okay.
Jack headed for the door with Kathy on his arm. The army captain at the stairs was very understanding. 5 minutes later, they were outside. Jack helped his wife into the car and headed back up the drive toward Pennsylvania.
Go straight, Kathy said.
But go straight, Jack.
It was her surgeon's voice, the one that told people what to do. Ryan pulled past Lafayette Park.
Now left.
Where are we supposed to be going?
Now turn right and left into the driveway.
But,
Jack, please, Kathy said softly.
The doorman of the Hay Adams Hotel helped Carolyn from the car. Jack handed the keys to the parking attendant, then followed his wife in. He watched the concierge hand her a key, then she breezed off to the elevators. He followed her onto and off the elevator, and from there to a corner suite.
What gives, Kathy?
Jack, there's been too much work, too much kids, and not enough us.
Tonight, my darling, there is time for us.
She wrapped her arms around his neck, and there was nothing for her husband to do but kiss her.
She put the key in his hand.
Now get the door open before we scare somebody.
But what about,
Jack? Shut up, please, she added.
Yes, dear.
Ryan led his wife into the room.
Kathy was gratified to see that her instructions had been carried out as perfectly as the staff of this most excellent of hotels could manage. A light dinner was set on the table, along with a chilled bottle of Moet. She draped her coat on the sofa in confidence that everything else was as it should be. "Could you pour the champagne? I'll be back in a moment." "You might want to take your coat off and relax," she said over her shoulder on the way into the bedroom. "Sure," Jack said to himself. He didn't know what was going on or what Kathy had in mind, but he didn't really care all that much either. After dropping his dinner jacket atop his wife's mink, he peeled the foil off the champagne, then twisted off the wire and gently worked the cork free. He poured two glasses and set the bottle back in the silver bucket. He decided to trust the wine untasted, then walked to look out the window at the White House. Jack didn't hear her come back into the room. He felt it, felt the air change somehow. When he turned, she was standing there in the doorway. It was the second time she'd worn it, the floor-length gown of white silk. The first time had been their honeymoon. Kathy walked barefoot across the carpet to her husband, gliding through space like an apparition. "Your headache must have gone away." "I'm still thirsty, though," Kathy said, smiling up at Jack's face. "I think I can handle that." Jack lifted the glass and held it to her lips. She took a single sip, then moved it to his. "Hungry?" "No." She leaned against him, taking both his hands in hers. "I love you, Jack. Shall we?" Jack turned her around and walked behind, his hands at her waist. The bed, he saw, was turned down and the light out, though the glare from the floodlit White House washed in through the windows. "Remember the first time? The first night we were married?" Jack chuckled. "I remember both, Kathy." "This is going to be another first time, Jack." She reached behind him and flipped off the cummerbund. Her husband took the cue. When he was naked, she embraced him as fiercely as she could manage, and the silk of her nightgown rustled against his skin. "Lie down." "You're more beautiful than ever, Kathy." "I wouldn't want anyone to steal you from me." Kathy joined him on the bed. He was ready, and so was she. Carolyn pulled the nightgown up to her waist and mounted him, then let it fall down around her. His hands found her breasts. She held them in place, rocking up and down on him, knowing that he couldn't last very long, but neither could she. No man should be so lucky, Jack told himself, straining, trying to control himself, and though he failed miserably, he was rewarded with a smile that nearly broke his heart. "Not bad," Kathy said a minute later, kissing his hands. "Out of practice." "The night is young," she said as she lay down beside him. "And that's the best I've had in a while, too. Now, are you hungry?" Ryan looked around the room. Wait. She left the bed and returned with a bathrobe with the hotel monogram. "I want you to stay warm." Dinner passed in silence. There was nothing that needed to be said, and for the following hour they silently pretended that they were both in their 20s again, young enough to experiment in love, to explore it like a new and wonderful place where every turn in the road revealed something never before seen. It had been far too long, Jack told himself, but he dismissed the thought from a mind that for once was untroubled. Dessert was finished, and he poured the last of the champagne. "I have to stop drinking. But not tonight." Kathy finished off her glass and set it on the table. "It wouldn't hurt you to stop, but you're not an alcoholic. We proved that last week. You needed rest, and you got your rest. And now, I want more of you. If there's any left." Kathy stood and took his hand. "There's plenty more where that came from." This time Jack did the leading. Once in the bedroom, he reached down and pulled the nightgown over her head, then tossed his robe on the floor next to it. The first kiss lasted for some eternal period of time. He lifted her in his arms and lay her on the bed, joining her a moment later. The urgency had not passed for either of them. Soon he was atop her, feeling her warmth under and around him. He did better this time, controlling himself until her back arched and her face took on the curious look of pain that every man wants to give his wife. At the end, his arms reached under her and lifted her off the bed, up against his chest. Kathy loved it when he did that, loved her man's strength almost as much as his goodness. And then it was over, and he lay at her side. Kathy pulled him against her, his face to her regrettably flat chest. "There never was anything wrong with you," she whispered into his ear. She was not surprised by what came next. She knew the man so well, though she'd been foolish enough to forget the fact. She hoped that she'd be able to forgive herself for that. Jack's whole body shook with his sobs. Kathy held him fast to her, feeling his tears on her breasts. "Such a fine, strong man. I've been a lousy husband and a lousy father." Her cheek came down on the top of his head. "Neither one of us has set any records lately, Jack. But that's over, isn't it?"
"Yeah."
He kissed her breast. "How did I ever find you?" "You won me, Jack. In the great lottery of life, you got me. I got you. Do you think that married people always deserve each other? All the ones I see at work who just can't make it. Maybe they just don't try. Maybe they just forget. Forget what I almost forgot. For richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, as long as we both shall live. Remember? I made the promise, too. Jack, I know how good you can be, and that's plenty good enough. I was so bitchy to you last week. I'm sorry for all the terrible things I did. But that's all over." Presently, the weeping stopped. "Thanks, babe." "Thank you, Jack." She ran a finger down his back. "You mean..." His head moved back to see her face. He got another smile, the gentle kind that a woman saved for her husband. "I think so. Maybe this one will be another girl." "That might be nice. Go to sleep." In a minute, Jack rose to head for the bathroom, then into the sitting room before coming back. 10 minutes later, he was still. Kathy rose to put her nightie back on. And on her way back from the bathroom, she canceled the wake-up call that Jack had just ordered. It was her turn to stare out the windows at the home of the president. The world had never seemed prettier. Now, if she could just get Jack to quit working for those people. The truck made a fuel stop outside of Lexington, Kentucky. The driver paused 10 minutes to load up on coffee and pancakes. He found breakfasts best for staying awake on the road, then pressed on. The $1,000 bonus sounded pretty good, and to be sure of it, he had to cross the Mississippi before the rush hour in St. Louis. Chapter 31. Dancers. Ryan knew it was too late when the traffic woke him up and he saw that the windows were flooded with light. A look at his watch showed 8:15. That almost set off a panic attack, but it was too late to panic, wasn't it? Jack rose from the bed and walked into the sitting room to see his wife already working on her morning coffee.
"Don't you have to work today?"
"I was supposed to assist with a procedure that started a few minutes ago, but Bernie is covering for me. I think you ought to put some clothes on, though."
"How do I get to work?"
"John will be here at 9.
"Right."
Ryan walked off to shower and shave.
On the way, he looked in the closet and noted that a suit, shirt, and tie were waiting for him. His wife had certainly planned this one carefully. He had to smile. Jack had never thought of his wife as a master mistress of conspiracy. By 8:40, he was washed and shaved. "You know I have an appointment right across the street at 11.
"No, I didn't. Say hi to that Elliot bitch for me."
Kathy smiled. "You don't like her either?" he asked.
"Not much there to like. She was a crummy college teacher. She's not as smart as she thinks. Major ego problems."
"I've noticed. She doesn't like me very much."
"I did get that impression. We had a little fight yesterday." "I think I won," Kathy observed.
"What was it all about, anyway?"
"Oh, just a girl-to-girl thing."
Kathy paused.
"Jack?"
"Yeah, babe?"
"I think it's time for you to leave."
Ryan examined his breakfast plate. "I think you may be right. I have a couple more things to do. But when they're done..."
"How long?"
she asked. 2 months at the outside. I can't just leave, babe. I'm a presidential appointee. I had to be confirmed by the Senate, remember? You can't just walk away from that. It's like desertion if you do. There are rules you have to follow." Kathy nodded. She'd won her point already.
"I understand, Jack. 2 months is good enough. What would you like to do?"
"I could get a research job almost anywhere. Center for Strategic and International Studies, Heritage. Maybe the Johns Hopkins Center for Advanced International Studies. I had this talk in England with Basil. When you get to my level, you're never really gone." "I might even write another book." "We'll start off with a nice long vacation soon as the kids are out of school." "I thought I won't be too pregnant then, Jack." "You really think it happened last night?" Her eyes arched wickedly. "The timing was just about right. And you had 2 chances, didn't you?"
"What's the matter? You feel used?"
Her husband smiled. "I've been used worse."
"See me tonight?"
"Did I ever tell you how much I like that nightie?"
"My wedding dress? It's a little formal, but it did have the desired effect. Shame we don't have more time now, isn't it?"
Jack decided he'd better get out of here while he still could. "Yeah, babe, but I have work to do, and so do you."
"Aw," Kathy observed playfully.
"I can't tell the president that I was late because I was boffing my wife across the street." Jack came to his wife and kissed her.
"Thanks, honey." "A pleasure, Jack."
Ryan emerged from the front door to see Clark waiting in the drive-thru. He got right in.
"Morning, Doc."
"Hi, John."
"You only made one mistake."
"What's that?"
"Kathy knew your name."
"How?" "You don't need to know," Clark replied, handing over the dispatch box.
"Hell, sometimes I like to sack in myself, you know."
"I'm sure you broke some kind of law."
"Yeah, right."
Clark headed out.
"When do we get the go-ahead on the Mexico job?"
"That's what I'm going into the White House for."
11?
"Right." It was gratifying to see that the CIA could, in fact, operate without his presence. Ryan arrived on the 7th floor to see that everyone was at work. Even Marcus was where he belonged.
"Ready for your trip?" Jack asked the director.
"Yeah, heading off tonight. Station Japan is setting up the meet with Lee Allen.
Marcus, please remember that he is Agent Musashi, and his information is Nitaka. Using his real name even here is a bad habit to get into."
"Yeah, Jack." "You're heading down to see the president soon for the Mexico thing."
"That's right."
"I like the way you set that thing up."
"Thanks, Marcus. But the credit goes to Clark and Chavez."
Open to a suggestion? Jack asked.
Go ahead.
Put them back in operations?
If they bring this one off, the president will go along with it. So will I.
Fair enough.
That, Jack thought, was pretty easy.
He wondered why.
Dr. Kaminsky went over the films and swore at himself for his error of the previous day. It hardly seemed possible, but it wasn't possible. Not here. Was it? He had to run some additional tests, but first he spent an hour tracking down his Syrian colleague. The patient was moved to another hospital, one with a laminar room. Even if Kaminsky were wrong, this man had to be totally isolated.
Russell fired up the forklift and took several minutes to figure out the controls. He wondered what the previous owner had needed with one, but there was no point in that. There was enough remaining pressure in the propane tanks that he didn't have to worry about that either. He walked back to the house. The people here in Colorado were friendly enough. Already the local newspaper distributors had set up the delivery boxes at the end of the drive. Russell had the morning paper to read with his coffee. A moment later, he realized how good a thing that was.
Uh-oh, he observed quietly.
What is the problem, Marvin?
I've never seen this before. The Vikings fans are planning a convoy. Over 1,000 cars and buses.
Damn,
he noted. That'll screw the roads up. He turned to see the extended weather forecast.
What do you mean?
They have to come down I-76 to get to Denver. That might mess things up some. We want to arrive about noon, maybe a little later. About the same time the convoy is supposed to arrive.
Convoy?
What do you mean?
Convoy defending against what? Cotty asked.
Not a real convoy, Russell explained. More like a motorcade. The fans from Minnesota have a big deal laid on.
Tell you what,
let's get a motel room for us. One close to the airport. When's our flight? He paused.
Jesus, I really haven't been thinking very clear, have I?
What do you mean? Gone asked again.
Weather, Russell replied. This is Colorado, and it is January. What if we get another snowstorm?
He scanned the page.
Uh-oh. For driving, you mean?
That's right. Look, what we ought to do is get rooms reserved. One of the motels right by the airport, say. We can go down the night before. Or I'll get the rooms for three nights, so there won't be any suspicion.
Christ, I hope there's vacancies.
Russell walked to the phone and flipped open the yellow pages right next to it. It took him 4 tries to find a room with twin doubles in a little independent place a mile from the airport. This he had to guarantee with a credit card that he'd managed not to use until now. He didn't like having to do that. One more bit of paper for his trail.
Good morning, Liz. Ryan walked into the office and sat down. How are you today? The National Security Advisor didn't like being baited any more than the next person. She'd had a little battle with this bastard's wife in front of reporters and taken her lumps publicly. Whether Ryan had had anything to do with it or not, he must have had a good laugh about it last night. Worse than that, what that skinny little bitch had said also went after Bob Fowler, didn't it? The president had thought so on being told last night.
You ready for the brief?
Sure am.
Come on.
She'd let Bob handle this. Helen D'Agostino watched the two officials enter the Oval Office. She'd heard the story, of course. A Secret Service agent had heard the whole thing, and the vicious put-down administered to Dr. Elliot had already been the subject of a few discreet chuckles.
Good morning, Mr. President, she heard Ryan say as the door closed.
Morning, Ryan.
Okay, let's hear it.
Sir, what we plan to do is actually fairly simple. 2 CIA officers will be in Mexico at the airport,
covered as airline maintenance personnel. They'll do the normal stuff, emptying ashtrays, cleaning the johns. Before they leave, they will place fresh flower arrangements in the upstairs lounge. Concealed in the arrangements will be microphones like this one. Ryan pulled the plastic spike from his pocket and handed it over. These will transmit what they pick up to a second transmitter concealed in a bottle. That device will broadcast a multi-channel EHF, that's extremely high-frequency signal, out of the aircraft. A series of three other aircraft will fly parallel courses with the 747 to receive that signal. An additional receiver with a tape recorder attached will be concealed on the 747, both as a backup to the air-to-air links and as a cover for the operation. If it's located, the bugs will seem to be something done by the news people accompanying the Prime Minister. We don't expect that, of course. We'll have people at Dulles to recover our gadgets. In either case, the electronic transmission will be processed and the transcripts presented to you a few hours after the aircraft lands.
Very well. What are the chances for success? Chief of Staff Arnold Van Damme asked.
He had to be there, of course. This was more an exercise in politics than statecraft. The downside political risk was serious, just as the reward for success would be more than noteworthy.
Sir, there are no guarantees for operations of this kind. If something is said, it is likely that we'll know what it is, but he might not even discuss the matter at all. The equipment has all been tested. It works. The field officer running this operation is well experienced. He's done touchy ones before.
Like? Van Damme asked.
Like getting Gerasimov's wife and daughter out a few years ago. Ryan explained on for a minute or so.
Is the operation worth the risk? Fowler asked.
That surprised Ryan quite a bit.
Sir, that decision is yours to make.
But I asked you for an opinion.
Yes, Mr. President, it is. The take we've been getting from Nitaka shows a considerable degree of arrogance on their part. Something like this might have the net effect of shocking them into playing honest ball with us.
You approve of our policy of dealing with Japan? Van Damme asked, just as surprised as Ryan had been a moment earlier.
My approval or disapproval is beside the point, but the answer to your question is yes.
The Chief of Staff was openly amazed.
But the previous administration...
How come you never told us?
You never asked, Arnie. I don't make government policy, remember? I'm a spook. I do what you tell me to do, as long as it's legal.
You're satisfied on the legality of the operation? Fowler asked with a barely suppressed smile.
Mr. President, you're the lawyer, not me. If I do not know the legal technicalities, and I don't, I must assume that you, as an officer of the court, are not ordering me to break the law.
That's the best dance number I've seen since the Kirov Ballet was in Kennedy Center last summer, Van Damme observed with a laugh.
Ryan, you know all the moves.
You have my approval, Fowler said after a brief pause.
If we get what we expect, then what?
We have to go over that with the State Department guys, Liz Elliott announced.
That is potentially dangerous, Ryan observed. The Japanese have been hiring a lot of people from the trade negotiation section. We have to assume that they have people inside.
Commercial espionage? Fowler asked.
Sure, why not?
Nitaka has never given us hard evidence of that. But if I were a bureaucrat looking to leave government service and make half a mil a year representing them, like a lot of them do, how would I present myself to them as a potentially valuable asset?
I'd do it the same way a Soviet official or spook presents bona fides to us. You deliver something juicy up front.
That's illegal, but we're not devoting any assets to looking at the problem. For that reason, wide dissemination of the information from this operation is very dangerous. Obviously, you'll want the opinion of Secretary Talbot and a few others, but I'd be really careful how much farther you spread it.
Also, remember that if you tell the PM that you know what he said, and if he knows he only said it in one place, you run the risk of compromising this intelligence-gathering technique. The president accepted that without anything more than a raised eyebrow.
Make it look like a leak in Mexico? Van Damme asked.
That's the obvious ploy, Ryan agreed. And if I confront him with it directly, Fowler asked.
Kind of hard to beat a straight flush, Mr. President. And if this were ever to leak, Congress would go ballistic.
That's one of my problems. I'm required to discuss this operation with Al Trent and Sam Fellows. Sam will play ball, but Al has political reasons to dislike the Japanese.
I could order you not to tell him.
Sir, that's one law I may not break for any reason.
I might have to give you that order, Fowler observed.
Ryan was surprised again. Both he and the president knew what the consequences of that order would be. Just what Kathy had in mind. It might, in fact, be a fine excuse to leave government service.
Well, maybe that won't be necessary. I'm tired of playing patty cake with these people. They made an agreement, and they're going to keep it or have to deal with a very irate president. Worse than that, the idea that someone can suborn the president of a country in so venal a way is contemptible. God damn it, I hate corruption.
Right on, boss, Van Damme commented. Besides, the voters will like it.
That bastard, Fowler went on after a moment. Ryan couldn't tell how much of this was real and how much feigned. He tells me he's coming over to work out a few details, get acquainted some more, and what he's really planning is to welsh on a deal. Well, we'll see about that. I guess it's time he learned about hardball. The discourse stopped.
Ryan, I missed you last night.
My wife got a headache, sir. Had to leave. Sorry.
Feeling all right now?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Turn your people loose.
Ryan stood.
Will do, Mr. President.
Van Damme followed him out and walked him to the west entrance.
Nice job, Jack.
Gee.
They going to start liking me? Jack asked wryly. The meeting had gone much too well.
I don't know what happened last night, but Liz is really pissed at your wife.
They talked about something, but I don't know what.
Jack?
You want it straight? Van Damme asked.
Ryan knew that the friendly walk to the door was just too convenient, and the symbolism was explicit enough, wasn't it?
When, Arnie?
I'd like to say it's just business and not personal. But it is personal.
I'm sorry, Jack, but it happens.
The president will give you a glowing send-off.
Nice of him. Jack replied matter-of-factly.
I tried, Jack. You know I like you.
These things happen.
I'll go quietly.
But I know.
No back shots on the way out or after you're gone.
You'll be asked in periodically, maybe draw some special missions, liaison stuff. You get an honorable discharge.
On that, Jack, you have my word of honor and the president's.
He's not a bad guy, Jack. Really, he isn't. He's a tough-minded son of a bitch and a good politician. But he's as honest as any man I know. It's just that your way of thinking and his way of thinking are different. And he's the president.
Jack could have said that the mark of intellectual honesty is the solicitation of opposing points of view. Instead, he said,
like I said, I'll go quietly. I've been doing this long enough.
It's time to relax a little, smell the roses, and play with the kids.
Good man.
Van Damme patted his arm.
You bring this job off, and your going-away statement from the boss will sparkle. We'll have Callie Weston write it, even.
You stroke like a pro, Arnie. Ryan shook his hand and walked off to his car. Van Damme would have been surprised to see the smile on his face.
Do you have to do it that way?
Elizabeth, ideological differences notwithstanding, he has served his country well. I disagree with him on a lot of things, but he's never lied to me, and he's always tried to give me good advice, Fowler replied, looking at the plastic stick microphone. He suddenly wondered if it was working.
I told you what happened last night.
You got your wish. He's on the way out. At this level, you do not throw people out the door. You do it in a civilized and honorable way. Anything else is small-minded and decidedly stupid politically. I agree with you that he's a dinosaur, but even dinosaurs get a nice spot in the museums. But that's all. Okay, you had words with his wife last night. I'm sorry about that. But what kind of person penalizes someone for what their wife did?
Bob, I have a right to expect your support.
Fowler didn't like that, but responded reasonably. And you have it, Elizabeth. Now this is neither the time nor the place for this sort of discussion. Marcus Cabot arrived at Andrews Air Force Base just after lunch for his flight to Korea. The arrangements were more luxurious than they looked. The aircraft was a U.S. Air Force C-141B Starlifter, an aircraft with four engines and an oddly serpent-like fuselage. Loaded into the cargo area, he saw, was essentially a house trailer complete with kitchen, living, and bedrooms. It was also heavily insulated. The C-141 is a noisy aircraft, especially aft. He went out the front door to meet the flight crew. The pilot he saw was a blonde captain of 30 years. There were, in fact, two complete flight crews. The flight would be long, with a fueling stop at Travis Air Force Base in California, followed by three mid-air tankings over the Pacific. It would also be singularly boring, and he would sleep through it as much as possible. He wondered if government service was really worth it, and the knowledge that Ryan would soon be gone, Arnold Van Damme had gotten the word to him, didn't improve his outlook. The director of Central Intelligence strapped himself in and started to read through his briefing documents. An Air Force non-com offered him a glass of wine, which he started on as the aircraft taxied off the ramp. John Clark and Domingo Chavez boarded their own flight later that afternoon from Mexico City. It was better, the senior man thought, to get settled in and acclimated. Mexico City was yet another high-altitude metropolis whose thin air was made all the worse by air pollution. Their mission gear was carefully packed away, and they expected no trouble with customs clearance. Neither carried a weapon, of course, as this sort of mission did not require it. The truck pulled off the interstate exactly 38 hours and 40 minutes after leaving the cargo terminal at Norfolk. That was the easy part. It took 15 minutes and all the driver's skill to back his rig up to the concrete loading dock outside the barn. A warm sun had thawed the ground into a 6-inch deep layer of gooey mud that almost prevented him from completing the maneuver, but on the third try he made it. The driver jumped down and walked back toward the dock.
How do you open this thing? Russell asked.
I'll show you. The driver paused to scrape the mud off his boots, then worked the latch on the container.
Need help unloading?
No, I'll do it myself. There's coffee over in the house.
Thank you, sir. I could use a cup.
Well, that was easy enough, Russell said to Cotty as they watched the man go away. Marvin opened the doors and saw a single large box with Sony printed on all four sides, along with arrows to show which side was up, and the image of a champagne glass to tell the illiterate it was delicate. It was also sitting on a wooden pallet. Marvin removed the fasteners that held it in place, then fired up the forklift. The task of removing the bomb and putting it inside the barn was completed in another minute. Russell shut the forklift down, then draped a tarp over the box. By the time the trucker came back, the cargo box was again closed.
Well, you got your bonus, Marvin told him, handing over the cash.
The driver riffled through the bills. Now he got to drive the box back to Norfolk, but first he'd hit the nearest truck stop for 8 hours of sleep.
A pleasure doing business with you, sir.
You said you might have another job for me in a month or so.
That's right.
Here's how you reach me. The trucker handed over his card. Heading right back? After I get some sack time. I just heard on the radio there's snow coming tomorrow night. A big one, they say. That time of year, isn't it?
Sure is.
You have a good one, sir.
Be careful, man, Russell said, shaking his hand one more time.
It's a mistake to let him go,
Gon observed to the commander in Arabic.
I think not. The only face he has really seen is Marvin's, after all.
True.
Have you checked it? Conti asked.
There is no damage to the packing box.
I will do a more detailed check tomorrow.
I would say that we are almost ready.
Yes. Do you want the good news or the bad news? Jack asked.
Good first, Kathy said.
They're asking me to resign my position.
What's the bad news?
Well, you never really leave. They'll want me to come back occasionally. To consult, stuff like that.
Is that what you want?
This work does get in your blood, Kathy. Would you like to leave Hopkins and just be a doc with an office and patients and glasses to prescribe?
How much?
Couple times a year, probably. Special areas I happen to know a lot about. Nothing regular.
Okay. That's fair.
And no, I couldn't give up teaching young docs.
How soon?
Well, I have two things I have to finish up with. Then we have to pick someone for the job. How about the Foleys, Jack thought. But which one?
Khan, sonar. Khan, aye, the navigator answered.
Sir, I got a possible contact bearing 295. Very faint, but it keeps coming back.
On the way.
It was a short 5 steps into the sonar room.
Show me.
Right here, sir.
The sonar man pointed to a line on the display. Though it looked fuzzy, it was in fact composed of discrete yellow dots in a specific frequency range, and as the time scale moved vertically upward, more dots kept appearing, regular only in that they seemed to form a vague and fuzzy line. The only change in the line was a slight drift in direction.
I can't tell you what it is yet.
Tell me what it isn't.
It ain't no surface contact, and I don't think it's random noise either, sir.
The petty officer traced it all the way to the top of the tube with a grease pencil.
Right about here, I decided it might actually be something.
What else you got?
Sierra 15 over here is a merchant heading southeast and way the hell away from us. That's a third CZ contact we've been tracking since before turn of the last watch, and that's about it, Mr. Pitney. I guess it's too bumpy topside for the fishermen to be out this far.
Lieutenant Pitney tapped the screen.
Call it Sierra 16 and I'll get a track started. How's the water?
Deep channel seems very good today, sir. Surface noise is a little tough, though.
This one's tough to hold.
Keep an eye on it.
Aye, aye. The sonar man turned back to his scope. Lieutenant Jeff Pitney returned to the control room, lifted the growler phone, and punched the button for the captain's cabin.
Gator here, Captain. We have a possible sonar contact bearing 295, very faint.
Our friend might be back, sir.
Yes, sir.
Pitney hung up and hit the 1MC speaker system.
Man the fire control tracking party.
Captain Ricks appeared a minute later, wearing sneakers and his blue coveralls. His first stop was to control, to check course, speed, and depth. Then he went into sonar.
Let's see it.
Damn thing just faded on me again, sir, the sonar man said sheepishly.
He used a piece of toilet paper. There was a roll over each scope to erase the previous mark and penciled in another.
I think we have something here, sir.
I hope you didn't interrupt my sleep for nothing, Ricks noted. Lieutenant Pitney caught the look the two other sonar men exchanged at that.
Coming back, sir.
You know, if this is an Akula, we should be getting a little pump noise in this spectrum over here.
Intelligence says he's coming out of overhaul. Ivan is learning how to make them quieter, Ricks said.
Guess so.
Slow drift to the north. Call the current bearing 297.
Both men knew that figure could be off by 10 degrees either way. Even with the enormously expensive system on Maine, really long-distance bearings were pretty vague.
"Anybody else around?" Pitney asked. "Omaha is supposed to be around somewhere south of Kodiak. Wrong direction. It's not her."
"Sure it's not a surface contact?"
"No way, Captain. If it was diesel, I'd know it. And if it was steam, I'd know that, too. There's no pounding from surface noise. Has to be a submerged contact, Captain."
"Only thing makes sense."
"Pitney, we're on 281?
"Yes, sir."
"Come left to 265. We'll set up a better baseline for the target motion analysis. Try to get a range estimate before we turn in."
Turn in, Pitney thought. Jesus, boomers aren't supposed to do this stuff.
He gave the order anyway, of course.
"Where's the layer?"
150 feet, sir. Judging by the surface noise, there's 25-footers up there, the sonar man added. "So he's probably staying deep to smooth the ride out."
"Damn, lost him again."
"We'll see what happens when the tail straightens back out." Ricks leaned his head out of the sonar room and spoke a single word. "Coffee." It never occurred to him that the sonar men might like some too. It took 5 more minutes of waiting before the dots started appearing again in the right place.
"Okay, he's back,
I think," the sonar man added.
"Bearing looks like 302 now."
Ricks walked out to the plotting table. Ensign Shaw was doing his calculations along with a quartermaster. "Has to be 100,000+ yards. I'm assuming a northeasterly course from the bearing drift, speed of less than 10. Has to be 100K yards or more." That was good, fast work, Shaw and the petty officer thought. Ricks nodded curtly and went back to sonar.
"Firming up, getting some stuff on the 50 hertz line now. Starting to smell like Mr. Akula, maybe."
"You must have a pretty good channel."
"Right, Captain. Pretty good and improving a little. That storm's gonna change it when the turbulence gets down to our depth, sir."
Ricks went into control again.
"Mr. Shaw?"
"Best estimate is 115K yards. Course northeasterly, speed 5 knots. Maybe 1 or 2 more, sir. If his speed's much higher than that, the range is awfully far."
"Okay. I want us to come around very gently. Come right to 080.
"Aye, aye, sir. Helm right 5 degrees rudder, come to new course 080.
"Right 5 degrees rudder, aye.
"Sir, my rudder is right 5 degrees, coming to new course 080.
"Very well."
Slowly, so as not to make too great a bend in the towed array, USS Maine reversed course. It took 3 minutes before she settled down on the new course, doing something no U.S. Fleet ballistic missile submarine had ever done before. Lieutenant Commander Claggett appeared in the control room soon thereafter.
"How long you figure he's going to hold this course?" he asked Ricks.
"What would you do?"
"I think I'd troll along in a ladder pattern," Dutch answered, "and my drift would be south instead of north, reverse of how we do it in the Barents Sea, right? Interval between sweeps will be determined by the performance of his tail. That's one hard piece of intel we can develop, but depending on how that number looks, we'll have to be real careful how we trail him, won't we?"
"Well, I can't approach to less than 30,000 yards under any circumstances. So, we'll close to 50K until we have a better feel for him, then ease it in as circumstances permit. One of us should be in here at all times as long as he's in the neighborhood."
"Agreed."
Claggett nodded. He paused for a beat before going on.
"How the hell," the XO asked very quietly indeed, "did Op-02 ever agree to this?"
"Safer world now, isn't it?"
"I suppose, sir."
"You're jealous that boomers can do a fast attack job?"
"Sir, I think that Op-02 slipped a gear. Either that or they're trying to impress some folks with our flexibility or something."
"You don't like this?"
"No, Captain, I don't. I know we can do it, but I don't think we should."
"Is that what you talked to Mancuso about?"
"What?"
Claggett shook his head.
"No, sir."
"Well, he did ask me that, and I said we could do it."
Not my place to enter into that yet.
Then what did you talk to him about? Rix wanted to ask. He couldn't, of course.
The Americans were a great disappointment to Oleg Kirillovich Kadyshev. The whole reason they'd recruited him was to get good inside information on the Soviet government, and he'd delivered precisely that for years. He'd seen the sweeping political changes coming for his country, seen them early because he'd known Andrei Ilyich Narmanov for what he was, and for what he was not. The president of his country was a man of stunning political gifts. He had the courage of a lion and the tactical agility of a mongoose. It was a plan that he lacked. Narmanov had no idea where he was going, and that was his weakness. He had destroyed the old political order, eliminated the Warsaw Pact through inaction, merely by saying out loud, only once, that the Soviet Union would not interfere with the political integrity of other countries, and had done so in the knowledge that the only thing that kept Marxism in place was the threat of Soviet force. The Eastern European communists had foolishly played along, actually thinking themselves secure in the love and respect of their people in one of history's most colossal and least understood acts of lunacy. But what made the irony sublime was that Narmanov could not see the same thing in his own country, to which was added one more fatal variable. The Soviet people, a term that never had any meaning, of course, were held together only by the threat of force. Only the guns of the Red Army guaranteed that Moldavians and Latvians and Tajiks and so many others would follow the Moscow line. They loved the communist leadership even less than their great-grandfathers had loved the Tsars. And so, while Narmanov had dismantled the party's central role in managing the country, he'd eliminated his ability to control his people, but left himself no ethos with which to supplant what had gone before. The plan, in a nation which for over 80 years had always had the plan, simply did not exist. So, necessarily, when turmoil began to replace order, there was nothing to do, nothing to point to, no goal to strive for. Narmanov's dazzling political maneuvers were ultimately pointless. Kadyshev saw that. Why didn't the Americans, who had gambled everything on the survival of their man in Moscow? The 46-year-old parliamentarian snorted at the thought. He was their man, wasn't he? He'd warned them for years, and they hadn't listened, but instead used his reports to buttress a man who was rich in skill but bereft of vision. And how could a man lead without vision? The Americans, just as foolish, just as blind, had actually been surprised by the violence in Georgia and the Baltic states. They actually ignored the nascent civil war that had already begun in the arc of southern republics. 500,000 military weapons had vanished in the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Mostly rifles, but some were tanks. The Soviet army could not begin to deal with the situation. Narmanov struggled with it on a day-to-day basis like some kind of desperate juggler, barely managing to keep up, taking his effort from one place to another, keeping his plates in the air, but barely. Didn't the Americans understand that some fine day all the plates would fall at the same time? The consequences of that were frightening to everyone. Narmanov needed a vision, needed a plan, but he didn't have one. Kadyshev did, and that was the entire point of his exercise. The Union had to be broken up. The Muslim republics had to go. The Balts had to go. Moldavia had to go. The Western Ukraine had to go. He wanted to keep the eastern part. He had to find a way to protect the Armenians, lest they be massacred by the local Muslims, and had to find a way to keep access to the oil of Azerbaijan, at least long enough until, with help from the West, he could exploit all the resources of Siberia. Kadyshev was a Russian. It was part of his soul. Russia was the mother of the Union. And like a good mother, she would let her children go at the proper time. The proper time was now. That would leave a country stretching from the Baltic to the Pacific, with a largely homogeneous population and immense resources that were scarcely catalogued, much less tapped. It could and should be a great, strong country,
powerful as any, rich in history and arts, a leader in the sciences. That was Kadyshev's vision. He wished to lead a Russia that was a true superpower, a friend and associate to other countries of European heritage. It was his task to bring his country into the light of freedom and prosperity. If that meant dismissing almost half of the population and 25% of the land, so be it. But the Americans weren't helping. Why this should be so, he simply did not understand. They had to see that Narmanov was a street without an exit, a road that merely stopped, or perhaps stopped at the brink of a great abyss. If the Americans couldn't help, then it was within his power to force them to help. That was why he had allowed himself to be recruited by Mary Foley in the first place. It was early morning in Moscow, but Kadyshev was a man who had long since disciplined himself to live on a minimum of sleep. He typed his report on an old, heavy, but quiet machine. Kadyshev used the same cloth ribbon many times. No one would ever be able to examine the ribbon to see what had been written on it, and the paper was from a sheaf taken from the office central supply room. Several hundred people had access to it. Like all professional gamblers, Kadyshev was a careful man. When he was finished, he used leather gloves to wipe the paper clean of whatever fingerprints he might have accidentally left on it. Then, using the same gloves, he folded the copy into a coat pocket. In 2 hours, the message would be passed. In less than 20, the message would be in other hands. Agent Spinnaker needn't have bothered. KGB was under orders not to harass the people's deputies. The coat check girl pocketed the paper, and soon thereafter passed it across to an individual whose name she did not know. That man left the building and drove to his own workplace. 2 hours after that, the message was in another container in the pocket of a man driving to the airport, where he boarded the 747 for New York.
"Where to this time, doctor?" the driver asked.
"Just drive around."
"What?"
"We need to talk," Kaminsky said.
"About what?"
"I know you are KGB," Kaminsky said.
"Doctor," the driver chuckled,
"I am an embassy driver."
"Your embassy medical file is signed by Dr. Fyodor Ilyich Grigoryev. He is a KGB doctor. We were classmates. May I go on?"
"Have you told anyone?"
"Of course not." The driver sighed. "Well, what could one do about that?"
"What is it you wish to talk about?"
"You are KGB, Foreign Directorate." There was no avoiding it.
"Correct. I hope this is important."
"It may be. I need someone to come down from Moscow. There's a patient I'm treating. He has a very unusual lung problem."
"Why should it interest me?"
"I've seen a similar problem before. A worker from Belayarsky. Industrial accident. I was called in to consult on it."
"Yes?
What is at Belayarsky?"
"They fabricate atomic weapons there."
The driver slowed the car.
"Are you serious?"
"It could be something else. But the tests I need to run now are very specific. If this represents a Syrian project, we will not get the proper cooperation. Therefore, I need some special equipment from Moscow."
"How quickly?"
"The patient isn't going anywhere, except into the ground. I'm afraid his condition is quite hopeless."
"I have to go through the resident on this. He won't be back until Sunday."
"Fast enough."
Chapter 32. Closure.
"Can I help?" Russell asked.
"Thank you, Marvin. But I would really prefer to do this myself. Without distractions," Gohn said.
"I understand. Yell if you need anything."
Ibrahim donned his heaviest clothing and walked out into the cold. The snow was falling quite hard. He'd seen snow in Lebanon, of course, but nothing like this.
The storm had scarcely begun half an hour before, and there was already more than 3 centimeters of it. The northerly wind was the most bitter he'd ever experienced, cutting into his very bones as he walked the 60 meters or so to the barn. Visibility was restricted to no more than 200 meters. He could hear the traffic on the nearby highway, but could not even see the lights of the vehicles. He entered